Howdy, Bill and Rob's fans. Rob here to let you know that we're busting today's episode out from behind the Patreon paywall because we're just so excited to share with you our Planet of the Apes series. If you like this episode, please consider joining our Patreon at patreon.com/billandrobs. It is so much fun. We do video episodes. We do all of our exclusive podcasts over there. And we just have a chill hang at patreon.com/billandrobs. You're going to join our exclusive club for friends, not fans, friends. It's $5 a month, which is less than most lunches, most drinks, most anything. But you get exclusive access to everything we put out, not just podcasts. Curated lists of movies, what we're watching in the future, what we're currently covering, and all the fun stuff involved. If you like today's episode covering Beneath the Planet of the Apes, well, there's about four more Planet of the Apes episodes that have come before this one, and plenty that are coming after. It takes support like you at patreon.com/billandrobs to help us continue making our show. We moved to a Patreon model because there are costs involved. And if you enjoy what Bill and I are doing, I really hope you consider testing out the podcast. I mean, not everyone has $5 to spare, and I understand that. So if you join for 1 month, press pause, that's cool. We really just want to create a fun hub where people can hang out, discuss movies, TV, leave comments on episodes, and feel like it's a space that's more than just about a podcast. There's a Discord attached. There's all sorts of activities that we plan on getting into, but we also just need your support to keep the lights on. Plain as day. So help us reach our goals and to keep this thing moving by joining us at patreon.com/billandrobs. Thanks in advance.
Welcome to Bill and Rob's An Excellent Adventure. I'm Bill Tilley.
And I am Rob Schulte. Bill, it's an incredible day for us here on this big blue planet of ours. Nothing wrong with it. Nothing going to happen. We're sailing into the future with only bright skies ahead. How are you doing, Bill?
I'm doing great, enjoying the status quo of the food chain and the fact that my species is still at the moment the dominant force on the planet. But I got to admit, the rest of it's coming up fast. So what we're going to talk about today is kind of hitting a little closer to home than it ever did before.
Today's a big day, though. I mean, like, why don't we let the people in on what's going on?
Today is a really big day. Today we are going to discuss the sequel to Planet of the Apes, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, and we're going to discuss it with a special guest. He is the driving force behind the Mego Museum, the Plaid Stallions website, the Pod Stallions podcast, the Brickman Tooth YouTube channel. He is a really great guy. I've been enjoying his content for years, and he is a predominant authority on the Planet of the Apes franchise, in my humble opinion. I'd like to introduce Mr. Brian Heller. How are you, Brian?
Not too bad. Thanks for having me. I rarely get referred to as special in a good way.
Well, you're on the right podcast, let me tell you. You know, we were talking before we hit the big red record button, but Bill and I have been doing this for a little while now. Started as just like lockdown hangouts, and then we're like, hey, there might be something here. And then Bill would share his thoughts on toys and old films, and I would be like, oh yeah, I kind of have that connection too, but I'm about 10 years younger than you, so I see it in a totally different light. And then we're like, I think we got something here. And so we did a series on the Predator films. Mm-hmm. We did a series on pre-MCU Marvel films. And now I was like, Bill, I must revisit the Planet of the Apes. And he was like, okay. And I was like, and I think we need to go in chronological order. So we had to watch the newer ones first with James Franco and whatnot. And he's like, well, once we get into the 70s, we got to ask Brian to come on. And then he showed me your YouTube page and the podcast. And I was like, Bill, you are sailing this ship, buddy. I am ready for it.
This is a huge obsession of mine. I do like the newer films, though.
Interesting.
I still consider the original is more fun and rewatchable.
I think that's kind of where we've been landing as well.
Yeah.
I had some qualms with the newer ones, but I think it's because I watched them so close together. I think if I would have gone in theaters and I think if I would have spaced it out a little bit more, I could have had more time to like reflect and think on them. But
yeah, I don't know how a buffet of that would work.
Yeah.
Because the first one's a real sad downer.
Yes.
And I wouldn't show it to my daughter because I thought, I don't want to listen to that. I'm crying.
You know, John Lithgow, so, he's forgetting everything.
Ape shall not depress ape.
Yeah. And so, yeah, but I gleefully showed her many of the classic ones, sometimes against her will.
That's what dads do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Bill, let's get into today's episode. Should I read the back of the VHS box?
I think you should. Let everybody know what we're getting into. Read the back of Beneath the Planet of the Apes.
I'm glad you're doing it because I can, like, I would need my special glasses.
Well, I definitely am bringing out the telescope for this one. The Hubble, if you will. Let's see here. So the problem we had last time, the only VHS copies of Planet of the Apes came many years after it came out. So it was already setting up the first in this series. And so we couldn't find a great back of the box. But let me tell you, this Beneath the Planet of the Apes back of the box, strap in, gentlemen, featuring Charlton Heston and James Franciscus. This sequel picks up where Planet of the Apes left off with astronaut Brent crashing through the time barrier in search of the vanished Taylor. He arrives on a future Earth where talking apes rule, and the last intelligent humans, a race of mutants who practice thought control, dwell in a subterranean city. There, they worship one remaining nuclear weapon, a cobalt bomb capable of destroying the entire planet and all life on it. Both an action-oriented science fiction adventure and a wry commentary on today's world, Beneath the Planet of the Apes is imaginative entertainment for fantasy buffs of all ages. Was wry different in the 70s and 80s than it is today?
Well, it was probably in a liquor cabinet.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, it just amazes me because I'm holding the Blu-ray here and it is like two scant paragraphs. And you just read a young adult novel.
Yeah, exactly.
On the back of that. Like, they are really selling that.
You know? Yes, yes. We've also found, like, whenever we covered Elektra, that, like, when there's not a lot to say about the film, they want to make sure everyone knows the sexy this and the muscular that.
Yeah.
Interactive menu.
Yes, exactly. But I loved it. I'm not going to jump to my rating quite yet, gentlemen, but I always have fun watching these films, especially the older ones, kind of like what you were saying, Brian. One thing I did look up, gentlemen, is what the hell a cobalt bomb was. And call it extreme ignorance. I just thought it was a nuclear weapon. A cobalt bomb is a type of salted bomb. A nuclear weapon designed to produce enhanced amount of radioactive fallout. But in the research I did, which was about 5 minutes, maybe less, it's just a theorized bomb. So very interesting.
How dare a movie about talking apes in the future.
Well, and they can't really fault Rob because he is younger. He didn't grow up in the nuclear bomb connoisseur era that you and I did, where you got to find out all kinds of wonderful different nuclear devices that could be put in suitcases or hidden inside a coconut or dropped from orbit. I mean, you know, you got to have a real backlog.
Let's not just forget germ warfare, too, like the Omega Man. Mm. Terrifying.
When all of these things just felt like fantasy. Oh, what a time.
I was scared of killer bees as a child. The swarm was
I have told Rob that exact same story. It is the one movie from youth that has just still traumatized me. I do not like bees. I see them coming out of the car vent. I'm out.
I'm Canadian, and I was afraid of sharks. I was afraid of, you know, killer bees. Like,
yeah, the 70s was really actually trying to save our lives by showing us intense amounts of death when you think about it.
Yeah. Don't go swimming. Don't leave the house.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of death, it looms all around in this film, gentlemen.
This is a dark movie.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you remember the first time you saw Beneath the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, boy, do I.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lay it on me, brother.
All right. My relationship with Planet of the Apes is lifelong, but I only saw pockets and snippets. We didn't have a lot of channel choices when I was a kid. So a lot of UHF channels were out of the way. So I didn't see a lot of this stuff until I was a little older. My understanding of Planet of the Apes was I had seen, you know, a film, I had seen the cartoon show and some TV show episodes. So I didn't fully understand what was going on. And when I first saw Beneath, I was 9 years old. I remember that. It had come on City TV, which was the Toronto station. And I had like three choices that evening. I had some sort of skiing event, which I wasn't into. The Exorcist, which I did not want to watch, and Beneath the Planet of the Apes. So when I saw Planet of the Apes, I was like, oh my God, Planet of the Apes, yes! I didn't realize how dark a film it was, or I didn't even understand what was going on. And to make matters worse, the station's print was extremely ruddy, and it almost gave it like a grindhouse feel. You know what I mean? Like a patina on it. And that sometimes makes a movie way sillier.
Sure.
Or way scarier.
Totally.
This was working in this effect. So I can remember freaking out when they started peeling their skin off. And yeah, spoilers. And, you know, I remember going like this panicked channel, like it was like a Simpsons, you know, like skiing. No, Exorcist. Ah, you know, like back to Planet of the Apes. And yeah, this movie messed me up. The bleeding lawgiver too. I remember being horrified at that. And just the whole, like, this would be a repeating thing with me as a kid, because I was a kid of the 70s, downer endings, you know, terrible downer endings for movies. And yeah, I thought about this a lot. Now I want to say as an adult, I love it. I'm kind of mildly obsessed with it. And I think it's my repeat go-to. It may be the top one next to Conquest. Ooh. Those are just like my two favorites. And I also love Battle. Believe it or not, I don't rewatch the first one a lot, but if it's on TV, I can't turn it off.
I think that's a sign of a great film, though.
Really. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's entirely why we started doing this podcast, because we were thinking all these films and it's like, kind of have sort of a tagline that even a bad movie can be a good time, which doesn't mean that a movie sets out to be bad. There's so much good behind a movie that sometimes gets a short shift or sequels are forgotten. And, you know, that's kind of our search for things like this is what kind of fun can you have with it? Sometimes it's easy. Sometimes it's hard. And I am always predispositioned with sequels to be like, you're kind of set up for probably failure. But this brought me back to a time as I'm watching this. And I'm with you, Brian. It's a different experience as an adult as it was as a kid, because I saw these very infrequently and usually on a cable channel that was mid-Saturday afternoon, and you might catch it, you might not. And you catch the end of it, and you don't know what's going on. And I did not know about the TV show. I hadn't seen the cartoon. But to watch this again and be like, man, this is a real piece of filmmaking. Like, they put a lot of effort into a thing, and they had a lot of issues they had to overcome, and they managed to squeak out a movie that's pretty awesome in a way that most sequels are not today. So it was really great to rewatch this.
Yeah. It's funny too, because this comes from the era when franchises and sequels were looked down upon. That was cheap B-movie stuff. And they went out of their way in this one to go, no more sequels. Yeah. And they still, you know, that was an artistic choice. Yeah. And they still made three more after.
Getting to the end of this, it was just like, well, where do they go from here?
Yeah.
Like, at least the other one is kind of like, well, they still exist. We only saw a person crying at the end on the beach. We have all of these unanswered questions. Mm-hmm. This one, I have not seen a Planet of the Apes past Beneath the Planet of the Apes. So I'm along for the ride as we go through these.
Oh, so you don't know That's amazing.
I know that another movie happens. I don't know what happens. So
yeah, and it was amazing reset when we watched Planet of the Apes, because you kind of remember a thing differently if you haven't seen it in a long time too. And also you kind of get caught up in just the snippets of things that are said about it over the years. The Statue of Liberty, this is Charlton Heston, he's a screen idol. And we watched the movie and it's like, you know, Taylor's kind of a jerk. He's
a misanthrope. Total.
He makes really awful decisions based on certain things. He's a sexist.
He's got an insane laugh 10 minutes in.
And you're going, wow, lots of these things aren't good. And even the people, nobody's really doing things that are for the best of everybody. You've got all this social stuff in your head of being an adult. And you're like, this is really strange that this has ever like got toys made out of it. Why? Why would you do this? This is like Alien. But you see the appeal of it, like just talking apes versus man. It's like, okay, like I said, if I was a kid, I walked away with something completely different from viewing this movie than I did as an adult. And I saw this movie in a theater a few years ago, and Fathom Events did a rescreening in an actual movie theater.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. It was I think it was their anniversary. I can't remember exactly which one it was, but that was wild, because to see it on the big screen and be focused on the story, not just what was going on, it was like, there's a lot to this movie that I did not get on the first viewing.
Yeah, to me, that's the ultimate, is to be actually like films you've only ever seen on a small screen, going to see them on the big screen. It's like, it's an awakening almost.
Totally. I remember seeing a 75mm print of The Shining in the theaters, but it was like what you were saying, Brian, like maybe not the most upkept copy. And it was like very dirty, and it definitely made it even more frightening to have that sort of like textured grindhousey sort of burn marks in the film too.
Yeah, it feels dirty watching it.
I feel like I need to wear an overcoat when I go to Planet of the Apes in theaters.
And you know, it can feel like, as you're well acquainted with, Brian, it can kind of feel like knockoff material, substandard equipment, substandard lighting. So, and turns out, nope. Wasn't that at all. Just saw a bad viewing of it.
There used to be a cinema that played a lot of retrospective stuff in Toronto called The Bloor. And when they would just be playing Muzak while you were waiting for the movie, it would be a warped record, which was one of my favorite touches ever in any.
You know. That's amazing. Bill, should we move on to our first segment?
I think we should. This segment is called Evolutionary Studies.
So, of course, we'll just be discussing the interesting, the fun, the shocking, the trivia, whatever really jumps out to us as something we discovered once we were watching this film and doing our own research afterwards. So I can go first with one of mine. I picked out a couple, guys, and I know you guys are more of the professorials of the School of Ape, so bear with me on this, but I thought it was pretty interesting that Orson Welles turned down the role of General, Ursus, right? Yeah, okay. Orson Welles turned down the role of General Ursus, and Burt Reynolds was considered for the role of Brent, but they didn't cast him because Franciscus looked more like Charlton Heston, which I guess I can see an executive making that decision, like, he's got to look like Heston. It's got to be like Heston. But if you could imagine Burt Reynolds and fucking Orson Welles in this movie, that would have been a different echelon of film.
If only they could have got Jackie Gleason and Burt Reynolds.
It would have been a prequel.
Yeah, wow. I just want to see General Ursus running around in a wagon going, I'm going to get you, you aping some bitch.
You know, the guy who played Jackie Gleason's son in those movies was a Tarzan, Mike Henry. So you could like have an alternate storyline there.
I love it when we spin down this rabbit hole.
Yeah, I live in a rabbit hole.
Yep. Inside my head too, Brian.
Yeah, I was born in the year of the rabbit.
Bill, what do you got?
So I found it interesting watching some of this that the budget for this movie was set around $5 million, which was a little less than what the original movie had, but it was pretty good. But when they got into production, Fox lost a bunch of money on some big movies like Hello, Dolly and Tora, Tora, Tora. And they cut the budget in half to about $2.5 million, roughly. And that is a huge, huge hit, especially for a science fiction movie. And one big way that you see where they cut some costs in this movie is all the scenes with the ape extras. And there are a lot of ape extras in this movie. A bunch of them get saddled with some very, very bad Party City ape and chimpanzee and orangutan mass.
That Superman costume with the rubber band.
Yeah, and I get it. Like
Gilbert Gottfried had a great bit about that, that he milked for 30 years about those background masks. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, you see, like, they're not, you can see the eyes are popped out, that they're clearly wearing it.
Oh, their mouths are just gaping open.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, I think the ape that chases Brent and Nova the first time, the singular one that shoots him in the arm, I'm pretty certain he's wearing an ape mask.
It's very possible.
Because he has no black around his eyes, which they would have for the appliances. His mouth never moves because he never yells, "They're over here." It's just solid looking.
I could be wrong, but I think there was, like, you know, two different kinds of rubber masks used. Like, I think the ones we really notice, like, you know, I think they focus right in on Zira clapping at one point. It's like, this is a bad shot because you just get, like, every dime store mask behind her. You know? Yeah. And then there was just some, like, really hastily applied stuff going on there as well.
Yeah, it's a real shocker when you, and they do linger on it long enough to see. So they're, yeah, from a distance, they're not bad. And I'm sure that probably saved a bunch of money, but I don't know why they kept any of these in the close up.
They just pretty much avoided crowd scenes. Like, even, well, they filmed the Conquest at night mainly. But yeah, I think they were even aware of how that looked.
Once the letters started coming in after this one, they were like, guys, we got to fix it next
time. You don't see the cheating so much in the next, like, three as you do in this one. At least, you know, that was my takeaway. I've never really noticed. I think there's a few in Conquest, but there's so much going on, you don't care. You're not focusing on soldiers walking.
Yeah, and you don't see it in the first one because there aren't really big, solid crowds of apes in the first movie.
Yeah.
I didn't spot any at all. If I went back and watched it again, which I'm sure we'll kind of be on the lookout for, but it didn't set you up for that in the first one that, yeah, this is a thing we had to do.
Yeah, no, I don't think it existed in the first one. This was definitely a cost-cutting measure.
For sure.
Because, you know, the first one was a real painstaking job, and they had good money.
Well, Brian, is there any factoids we haven't talked about yet?
I would like to go to Bill's point about how 20th Century Fox lost money on Hello, Dolly, but saved money by using the sets in Beneath, particularly that big staircase the mutants are on. That is from the Hello, Dolly big number, which is kind of ironic.
That's awesome.
And yeah, the Franciscus thing is weird. It's almost like they were going to try and, you know, double Heston.
Yeah.
You know, Heston, he had a no sequels. No, no, no. And then the president or whoever helped him at Fox begged him for a sequel. Like, you know, we greenlit this thing for you, so you have to come back. And he kind of worked it out where he's in the film for like 15 minutes. And I think Heston wanted there to be no more sequels. So yeah, he said, you got to blow up the world or something. And that's where this comes from. That ending is to appease Charlton Heston, but also they needed him. So it's this kind of, you know, 50-50 thing. And this is the only movie in the series without Roddy McDowall.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He is played by an actor by the name of David Watson. Not a really well-known actor, but... And this is just a weird little oddity, and it's hard to find pictures of him, but Bill will understand this, that Mego did not have the likeness rights for Charlton Heston. So they just released a generic figure called Astronaut. And it's this brown-haired guy with huge mutton chops. And it looks exactly like David Watson. Like, to where you're like, was there just a picture of David Watson in the materials they gave Mego? And, you know, like, you kind of wonder what's going on. I have no evidence of that, but
I love that theory though.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. When I look at the Astronaut Mego figure now, it makes me kind of think in a way of the Spaceballs costume, just in that helmet. I guess it's more kind of Star Wars Death Star Commander type of thing, but it's just, I loved it. It was just the time of genericness that you could just do this. I'm like, we just stick a head on something and call it Astronaut. Good enough. Because probably no kid was like Heston or nothing when they came to Kresge's to buy their Mego figures.
And the other thing was, and I love this, is I know for a fact that you could do anything you wanted with Planet of the Apes and they would approve it. But I remember Marty Abrams telling me when he signed the deal for Star Trek, the guy just said to him, do whatever you want. And it was like there was no, people are like, why does the Mugatu have clothes? Because no one cared. Like there was just, you know. I think whatever Mego paid Paramount, this guy got 10% of that. So he's pro-capitalism. Yeah.
Well, that's ironic because that would have made Gene Roddenberry proud too, because he liked to make some money on that.
Apparently he got shafted, but that's for another podcast.
True.
Well, the shafted pod with Star Trek toys is something I would definitely listen to. Bill, before we move on to the next segment, it looks like you might have another fun little piece of trivia here.
Yeah, I found this interesting because, you know, looking into the backstory of the movie, of course, all movies have drafts and different endings and rewrites that go along the way. This movie had apparently a lot of first drafts because,
oh yeah,
they were stuck with the idea of when they made the movie, it's like, well, how in the hell are we going to make a sequel to this movie that's story basically ended?
Sure, yeah.
And nobody really wanted. So one of the drafts had an ending where they wound up about 50 years in the future after the end event, which was more of a happy ending. No bomb. Everybody sort of survives. And Heston and Nova have gone off and built a life. And there's a new society. And they went so far as to create a half-ape, half-human child.
Yeah, there's a test makeup. Yeah.
Yeah, and they went for test makeup. And the studio was like, no. Because
yeah, that's going to play real good in the South.
Yeah, they actually were like, that's going to sound a lot like bestiality. And we're going to say no to that. And that's going to cost us our G rating. And that's our family market. And we want the movie to make money.
Yeah. And back then, a lot of risque stuff got a G rating.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, the Planet of the Apes. I had forgotten that these movies were G rated. And there you see Heston's butt in the first movie. And there's blood and all kind, a lot of cursing and stuff. And it just reminded me of how, yeah, back in the day, you could watch a movie and it's like, really?
You know the movie, The Naked Prey?
I've heard that title.
It's a really brutal, awesome movie about a hunter who's captured by a tribe in Africa and they do the most dangerous game thing. Like, it's got some brutal stuff in it. And my friend goes, yeah, I saw this when I was six. I just like went to the movies, you know.
Well, and then it wasn't until like the 80s that there was anything really beyond. Didn't it used to just be like G and then PG and then X?
Yeah, it was a really wide measuring stick. Like you look at the stuff that's G rated now, like the Hammer movies were G rated.
Yeah.
And you're like, "What?
That's wild."
Yeah.
I feel like part of that rating system might have been things that were like, well, nobody's going to believe this is real. They know they're watching a fantasy. And so you had a lot of leeway, but they applied that.
I think the ratings board guys all had action in World War II and were just like, that's nothing. You're a baby. Oh,
that is a magnificent theory.
Well, speaking of magnificent things, I think that we can move on to our next magnificent segment. This segment we call Oohs and Ahs, or if you want to get real silly, Oohs and Ahs. These are the likes and amusing moments from this film Beneath the Planet of the Apes. I started last time. Brian, let's start with you. What was something that you really liked about this film?
I do like the expansion into the Planet of the Apes universe. I was left wanting more. And one of the things I really love about the film is its design, particularly the old New York. Mm. I've always been a huge fan of the spaceship from the first one and this one. And, you know, it shows up again. And I think the Alpha Omega bomb is just an amazing prop. And there's a lot of that. Like, I still love the design, the Lawgiver, all that stuff is very impactful for me. So yeah, I think it's an iconic movie in that regard. And the makeup, the mutants,
oh yeah,
the cleverness of the script. And this is the other thing I forgot to mention. earlier on when I was talking about being scarred by this. I was raised Roman Catholic, and this movie is taking a real piss out of the Roman Catholic Church. And so I'm not only scared of the mutants, I'm scared my dad's going to see it. You know what I mean? Like, so I have like real world fear and like just basic fear. So now I find it kind of like satirical.
Totally.
And yeah, you know, and I kind of get it. And it's still like a little too on the nose, but fine. This movie also has some amazing actors that show up later in the Apes films or in other films, like Victor Bono's in here as one of the mutants. Don Pedro Colley's on there as one of the mutants. There's some interesting. Oh, and of course, Natalie Trundy makes her debut in the Planet of the Apes series. She would later own the Planet of the Apes series as she married Arthur P. Jacobs and became his widow. And she will show up in the next three films.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah. But she is the blonde mutant lady from,
you know. Ah, yes. Yes, yes, yes. That mutant. I know. I actually know exactly what you mean. Bill, what are some of your likes and amusing moments?
So just to finish that thought, shout out to Gregory Sierra, who is also one of the mutants in this. I love him as an actor. You know, when you see.
Oh, he's Mendez, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He's great. I have an action figure of him.
Oh, man. So what really hit me hard when I saw it on screen was I love seeing the ape army march out of Ape City. It's just great. It's kind of the Planet of the Apes image that I'm always looking for, to see them as this big, massive force going off to kick somebody's ass. I just wish it had paid off more, because they don't really fight anybody worthy of them. They just fight.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. This is likes, Bill.
Well, that's, I still like it.
I know. I'm just giving you a
hard time. That's why I liked it so much. They're marching. They do a lot of marching, and they just look great doing it. And that's why I said I wish they had gotten like another big species or somebody to really go up against, so they could have fired all those cannons and shot all those guns and thrown all those spears. Their training sequence is amazing, where they're stabbing straw dummies and
calisthenics.
Doing ape calisthenics made me laugh so hard, because it is straight out of the 70s of a Sears catalog of a useless maneuver where you just turnstile back and forth. Like, I guess the ape's power comes from the hips.
You just staying flexible, baby. Just staying flexible.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they got to do it. So that was just something I really loved. What about you, Rob?
I love everything you guys have mentioned. Like, ape calisthenics was on my short list. You know, I love the chase scene when Brent's in the cage. I loved seeing like the underground New York, like what you mentioned, Brian. I used to live in Brooklyn, and so like walking by some of these places in Manhattan and then like just seeing the artist interpretation of them beneath the Planet of the Apes was great. But honestly, guys, and I know this is because I did not exist in the 70s, the hyper 70s future human, whatever you want to call it, like the brains writing this movie into what they wanted to represent for the culture of the time. I loved it. I love seeing these like thought control mutants worshiping a bomb, you know. But like, the big thing for me is, I wonder how serious this was taken when it came out in 1970. You know, like, was it still a little hokey, or was it just like, wow, yeah, if we're not careful, we're going to destroy our planet and then end up with mutants worshiping a bomb, you know? And maybe it's somewhere in the middle. I don't know.
I think with each sequel, whatever serious impact, like its gravitas, starts to dissipate, and it's hard to know what the first sequel would have done. You know, maybe you got half the return the first one did. I think the first one has a lot more, I guess, symbolism and makes more arguments.
Sure.
And makes better arguments, like mankind sucks, and you know what, so do these apes, and those apes are us. And but yeah, this one doesn't have as many messages to deliver.
Well, should we go around and name our chimps, gentlemen?
I think so. But I have one question. Would they be hippies, or would they be Chimpies.
Ooh, I'm going to go with Chimpies. Live and let chimp.
Wouldn't it be Chippies?
Probably.
Chippies. Yeah. I did just watch the pilot episode of Dragnet this morning, and I forgot that it was all based on like hippies doing LSD.
Oh, those, like, I used to watch those at like 3 a.m. when I was in college because I swear to God, no one would believe me. Like, when they're trying to be cool, it's the, like, it's the greatest thing ever, you know? And I don't know. I've seen way too many of them, but they're all bizarre for how dated they are.
I love it.
It's such a great image. Rob will tell you, we are Plex buddies and sharing media back and forth. And I recently found a show from the 50s called Harbor Command, which is kind of like Dragnet at sea. And
what's that about?
Yeah. Yeah. It's cops at the harbor, basically. And my brother-in-law is in the Navy and he shares it too. And he watched it and he messages me. I love it when I get one from him because he just messages me and he'll say things like, this is amazing. It's like having a bullhorn inside your head. It's just they have a thought and then the narrator narrates 5 minutes and the actors do just background walking. And then it's all about drugs and they might as well have caught them with a bag that just says drugs on it.
Well, and I know we're off on a tangent here, but it's like when you watch the Rockford Files and they set up that they're at the police station for like 30 full seconds of screen time.
I just want to tell you, there's one episode of that new Dragnet that I watched once and I would love to track down again. And it's the racially sensitive episode where Joe and Colonel Potter are trying to recruit more officers of color.
Oh,
and
wow.
The encouragement speech he gives this guy is, it's just,
oh my God. I can only imagine.
It's this well-meaning, terrible, because he's not just saying we need more officers like you. He's saying we need more object describing words. And it's just like, wow, this is wrong. And I must be dreaming.
Oh my God. Yeah. I don't even realize which Dragnet I watched because
if it's in color, it's that new Dragnet, which is like chef's kiss.
Yeah, because there was the 50s so Dragnet, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And was that the same actors that were in the 50s?
It was. It would be like if we decided, you know what would be fun? Let's do Simon and Simon again.
Yeah.
You know, and they're both like 75 and don't care. You know?
Yeah, because I remember watching the 50s Dragnet in black and white on like Nick at Night.
Yeah, and that is totally appropriate for the era.
But the one I watched today was the pilot of the 70s one.
I think it's like late 60s.
Or late 60s, yeah.
Every episode is amazing.
I think what we've done here is written an endorsement for every television reunion movie ever made.
Yeah. Okay. Well, right. Let me get us back on track here with our champ chimp. Gentlemen, I gotta go. My champ chimp is Nova, because she got more to do this time. She got a line finally. And you know what? She got that heroic death. Maybe not the best death, and her character could have had a little bit more depth. But in my mind, we ain't getting Nova back in this series. So I better give her my champ chimp while I can. So that's my champ chimp. Bill, who's your champ chimp?
So my champ chimp is actually behind the scenes on this one. I'm giving it to director Ted Post. You know, he got his budget slashed. He got handed an ambitious movie sequel that only really the studio Bean Counters wanted, and not a lot of other people had started out wanting it. And he managed to make a really good product with all this. He made a really great sequel. Maybe it's not the sequel that everybody wanted or it could have been, but the end result is undeniably fun and really great to watch. And it solves a good bit of the pacing problems, Rob, that we talked about from the first movie. It's not just a straight rehash, even though he's even got an actor that looks like Charlton Heston. So I give it to him for making some, I was going to say chicken salad out of that, but I guess it's an H movie, so I'll stay away from that particular reference.
Banana salad.
Yeah, banana salad from Squash Bananas.
Yeah, I love it. Brian, who's your champ chimp?
I would have to give it to James Franciscus. Ooh. Because he was put in an unenviable position And that is the star of this franchise, you know, major Hollywood star, Mr. TV guy, is only available for 15 minutes. And then the audience has to watch you for, you know, the other 75, I'm assuming. I don't even know how long Beneath is. And not only does he pull that off, you know, it's nice that his character just kind of like figures it out in 15 minutes. So we don't have to like watch him stumble through, get trial. Like, you like him. You like him better than Taylor.
Yeah.
Because he's actually just a guy who doesn't want to be there. And he does a great job. I like James Franciscus. I wish he was in more stuff. I really like him. And, you know, of course, does he kill General Urko?
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. Or General Ursus. Yeah, he kills General Ursus. Yeah.
He gets that win.
I think he is the glue of the movie. He works. He's not just replacement Charlton Heston. He's a different guy, but you still want to like see where he's going to go.
It's almost like he found out that he was hired because he looked like Charlton Heston. And it was like, oh, well, let me actually make this role my own then.
And I wonder, Brian, I think he's a really great actor too. Say you make one change. What if he was just a brunette? If he just didn't have the same blonde hair, he had just a little less resemblance to Heston. Would you like him better or not so much?
It wouldn't matter a lick to me.
Okay.
You know, the other astronaut could be anyone.
Right.
Yeah.
It wouldn't bug me as long as they gave a convincing performance.
Yeah. You know, it didn't bother me within a few minutes of rewatching this movie. If he'd come out a brunette, it would have jump-started me and like, well, this is a different person. And then I wouldn't be drawing that parallel.
Yeah. The other problem I have is I saw Beneath before I saw Planet. So I had no problem as a kid accepting James Franciscus over Taylor, because I was like, who's Taylor?
Yeah.
So, that's an interesting thought process anyways.
Well, and also when you're a kid, like all adults kind of look the same anyway.
Yeah, yeah. They're all just like big and big, tired looking.
Hairy. Yeah.
Yeah.
They all kind of look like apes now that I think
about
it. Hey, you just gave us an idea for the t-shirt store, Rob. We could have one that says, who's Taylor? I'm a Beneath kid, and just see who gets it.
I love it. Bill, we got to start putting out these shirts.
We do.
Brian will buy one. I know that for sure, right? So, guys, we've talked about the positives. We've oohed and aahed over this whole thing, but we must find out what drove us all bananas.
So, I know through this entire thing, it almost sounds like I'm saying the opposite of what I'm trying to say, which is kind of a joy for this sequel. But one of the things I don't care too much for is, as much as I like James Franciscus in this movie, the writers have given Brent some bad decisions that he makes throughout the movie that jump out, which Heston had the same problem in the first movie. So this is not on him directly, but like when he first meets Nova, they take off and he takes no supplies into the desert with him. He just jumps on the horse and splits.
I can breathe. I'll be fine.
Yeah. But I would have at least taken the shovel. You can at least hit somebody with it. So you might need to take a ditch. He doesn't know where he's going. When they get to Ape City, he's kind of not really hiding well behind that one shrub in the middle of it. And
yeah,
he's doing Doctor Who hides.
He does. He changes out of his astronaut suit. Instead of burying it or anything like a spy would do, he just chucks it on the ground like 5 feet outside the city limits. I mean, they're little things, and they don't, in the end of the thing, take away from it. But he is the hero, so I would have liked to just tweak those just a little bit. If he'd left, like kind of like the hair, if he'd left with the canteen of water, if he just, you know, shoved the astronaut suit under a little bit, I would have liked it a little bit better. But I blame not him. That's a writing thing. He's writing what's on the page. So that really is on the fault of the writers and not Brent himself, which is why I still like him. So I don't hold it against him personally.
No, that makes sense. Brian, what drove you bananas?
I have never been a fan of the steam bath scene.
God.
It's just, they got a little too, like Icarus, they tried to fly too close to the sun.
Yeah.
And that scene is like, oh yeah, you really got the face makeup right.
Yep.
That is some real used car lot ape bodysuit happening. Why would an ape take a steam bath? Why would they ever do that?
It's just, It's a well-meaning, like, you know, just you shouldn't have tried.
Yeah, and it's such an aristocratic country club moment where they're like, this is where all big decisions are made in the bath.
They could. I would have rather them just done like ape golfing. Like, just give me some sort of like country club sport.
I get what you're saying. Like, that is definitely, they needed to have them doing something in the scene.
They could have been skeet shooting humans.
Yeah, like there should have been, like, you know, they're bowling.
Yeah.
It's just such a, oh, let's have them in the steam bath. And it's like, no. It's going to look like Spirit of Halloween.
Yeah.
Guys, I was going to say one thing that drove me bananas was just that, like, this has much better pacing than some of the things that we talked about in the previous movie, and way better pacing, I think, than the newer Apes movies. It still took like half of the movie before we got beneath the Planet of the Apes. And I kind of was like hoping there'd be a little bit more exploration. And we do a really good job of following Brent, and Brent doesn't have to go on the exact same journey that Taylor had to go on. But it still was like a, get to Ape City. Now I'm in Ape City and I meet some apes. And then it's like, now let's go off on our adventure. And
it doesn't have a big plot. They're, you know, it's clicking along. Yeah. I can't not defend that, but
I still loved every moment of it.
Yeah. It's a fun clicking, like, sure, I'll go with you.
Why not? Apes doing calisthenics. I'm here for it now. But being titled Beneath the Planet of the Apes, I thought there was going to be more cavernous adventures.
It sounds like a class action lawsuit waiting to happen.
You know, and I've got my quill and ink here.
I want half my money back.
Yeah. Bill, do you have any other things that drove you bananas before we choose our dirty apes?
So one of the things that drove me bananas, all you have to do is go to the credits of this movie and watch it and see the listing for Don Pedro Colley, who I've got to call out was magnificent as Sheriff Little from the Dukes of Hazzard, and Victor Buono, their listing of names that they're credited as is not great. And
yeah,
to the point where I don't really want to repeat it here. So just go look it up, because you need to go watch this movie. So when you do watch it, you'll see it when it gets to the credits. It's not a good look for the studio at all. And I cannot understand why in the world they did this.
Especially for 1970.
It's just bad. It's just bad. I can't for the life of me see a reason for that. It's such an easy fix, but it was just weird. I mean, at least it's buried at the end, but wow.
Yeah. Well, so I'll start with my dirty ape, and guys, call this a wild one, but I think Brent is going to have to be my dirty ape, and here's why.
Brian's never coming back on the show.
Yeah.
Hey, here I am, the young one, making my friends angry with my wild, wild convictions here. He's a little too serious for me. If, granted, he's in a very serious situation as an astronaut.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. He needed to make a couple jokes, right?
You know, I don't need a maniacal laugh like Heston did in the first one, but maybe... Mm-hmm. Maybe an eye roll here or there, just to be like, I am on this freaking planet full of apes. Come on.
What's the deal here? Yeah. I get you. I do. I think also Heston, Planet of the Apes, is technically like a one-man show.
It's true.
So he is a stronger actor than Franciscus. I get what you're saying.
But I loved Franciscus. Let's just say, like, I think he did a great job. I think the character of Brent was was just very down to business in a way that I felt he could have let loose a little bit more. That's where I'm at with it. Brian, who's your dirty ape?
Oh gosh. You know, I've been thinking about it the entire episode. And in a way, I don't love General Ursus.
Sure.
Because I like, as much as I love General Ursus. Because he's not in the original. So it feels weird to add him in like he's always been there. Mm. And you know, the fact of the matter is, I think he would have been in there. So I always felt like he was more of a plot device to put into war.
Yeah.
And even though he's a perfectly logical character, you know, like it's one of the most believable things that you could include into the Planet of the Apes. I don't know. I always felt like that was, he was just done there to drive the story.
I think that's totally fair.
Yeah.
Do you think maybe that Ursus supplants Dr. Zaius as sort of the quote villain unquote of this particular movie? Because Zaius
kind of came to grips.
Yeah. And because what I've noticed is this movie, Zaius takes a different approach, that at the end of the movie, he's ready to put Cornelius and Zira in jail. Who knows what's going to happen to him? He's lied. He's defended the faith. And in this movie, he's kind of more sympathetic to them. Apparently, he didn't put him in there. And so they needed a stronger bad guy for this one.
Yeah, maybe. I think you're right. I think the Zaius getting warmongery in the second one would have felt insincere, because he almost felt empathetic to Taylor at the end, because he knows he's going to find out that his civilization died, and that Zaius knew all along. And yeah, I don't know if the threat of one man would have panicked Zaius. So you're right. I think they had to flip the script, I guess, and just create this character, which, you know, sometimes feels organic, and then other times a new character feels a little inorganic. But I don't really hate the character. I think well done, well acted, and it makes sense that they would have a leader of their army. Like, you know.
And I totally feel like that fits the criteria for Dirty Ape, you know? Mm-hmm. I think you can love the player, hate the game of Ursus.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Bill, who's dirtying up your ape world?
My Dirty Ape is once again a behind the scenes, but I don't know who it was who thought it was a good idea.
Is this steam bath again? Is this?
No, it is not. It's probably more offensive than that. Whoever thought it was a good idea to use spousal abuse as an okay way for a cover story to keep your house in line. We know it's fake when Cornelius and Zira put this out to Zaius that he is kind of whapped her one to keep her in line after her display out in front of all the apes at the big meeting in front of the general. But, you know, and it only is a second, and Zaius is on board with it when he first hears, like, you probably deserved it. And then it goes away really fast, and they almost actually reverse it a little bit before he walks out the door. But man, that was just gross. It took me a second to recover from that one. It was such just a weird drop right in the middle of this exchange. And I'm like, they could have come up with a million other things besides that, because it just looked weird. And I have to give a quick honorable mention for my Dirty Ape to Mego for not making an underground New York cardboard playset for this one.
But they did. They did make the Forbidden Zone playset.
They absolutely did. But boy, I know little Robs would have loved a yard sale underground New York playset to play with. So
I would have. It's so true.
You know what? It's weird how much I played Apocalypse as a child.
Bill, I gotta say, I think whoever wrote those shitty credits was asked to come in and do a punch up on that scene.
Oh man,
no pun intended.
I think I doubled down without even trying. I hope that's the case. I hope it was just one, you know, mushy banana in the bunch that was the cause of that.
This is a banana with brown spots that we can't even make bread out of.
Yeah, no, it's an uncomfortable scene for sure. And it's in the comic book.
Oh,
Lord. I think it's even on the Power Record.
Wow.
Oh, my God. It's on the Power
Record. What would you triple on that one?
It's always the crazy things or the weird things where you're just like, this went through a lot of different people before it actually even made it to the screen.
Yeah.
And everyone signed off. And I think the same thing every time I read Stephen King's It. Like, how many people read this before it got published? Okay. All right. Well, we've reached that time in the episode, gentlemen, where we give our final thoughts. It's time to take care of some monkey business. After our final thoughts, we are going to ask everyone if you would call this movie a packed house or a madhouse. And you can also interpret either of those however you want, as long as it fits into your final thoughts. Guys, I will go first on my final thoughts. Then we'll throw to Bill, and Brian will let you close it out.
Sounds good.
Like I said before, I think they could have done a little bit better job getting us underground. I think they could have explored that a little bit further, but it was still a lot of fun seeing the expansion of this world, seeing the lore grow. You know, I loved where this film took the original. The chase scene with the cage was fun. I still can't get over ape calisthenics. Amazing. But then when we do go underground, like I said, a little self-serious, a little thought-control-y, weird 70s crystals and bomb worship. Like, we're in the future, right? But we're worshiping a bomb. It's just a bit of a leap. And I think you said it right, Brian, where, you know, each movie takes a little bit away from the seriousness of the one prior. And this is right in line with the, oh, we destroyed our own planet. We did it to ourselves. And now it's like, and we did it so much that we now love the thing that destroyed our own planet.
And we did it again.
But all of that being said, I got to go with Packed House. This one's packing the house at my house. It's going to pack any theater I go to. Well, I loved it. How about you, Bill?
I think that this movie is a really interesting thing, a really exciting thing. Of course, it's got some issues. We've covered those. All movies do. No movie is perfect. And this is a sequel. It basically, in a lot of ways, I think, launched the modern idea of what sequels are going to be and did it a lot better than a lot of new movies do. That's for sure. Especially because it can't bank on the twist of the original movie. That's already been out there. We're not going to be surprised by that. But it has a clear plot, and it doesn't lean on the old movie for that. It does a really good job of building on what came before in Planet of the Apes. It retreads a few ideas, but that's kind of to be expected. But it doesn't feel like a retread. It's got new characters alongside the older characters, and the older characters are actually a little more off to the side, except for Nova and Zaius. It takes us on this fun ride. It takes us in the places we want to go. We want to see more of Apes World because that was really interesting. We don't know what's on the other side of the Forbidden Zone any more than Taylor did, and that's the excitement of it. And that was a great way to finally come to a basis of what the sequel is going to be. And I had a great time watching all of it, even the things that took me off guard where I didn't necessarily like, they blipped on by. And when I was done, I had a smile on my face for the entire ride of this movie. I think it sets the bar for what all sequels should try to be. You build on, find something else about the story to tell and tell it. Don't just go back and to try to capture the same thing all over again. I think that's what a lot of modern movies and a lot of modern sequels and remakes do. And I think more than often than not, they miss this bar entirely. So I think Beneath the Planet of the Apes is a packed house kind of a film. It will pack you full of smiles. It's a great movie. It's a great fun experience. It does all these things. And even the serious stuff will give you something to think about while you're doing it. It's done in a great non-heavy-handed way. And in a lot of places, it goes by fast. It's quick. It's the essence of a great 70s movie. So we're packing the house. We're bringing all the bananas. We're bringing all the orangutans and the chimps and the gorillas. We're all going to come together in this massive theater in our minds and watch this movie together. So I'm all for it. Brian, what are your final thoughts?
First of all, I just want to say I love this movie, warts and all. And the warts for me are the fact that this reeks of a studio just trying to copy the success of something else, but for half the price. Like the cost cutting, the sheer commerciality of it left aside. The thing that I like about this and the Planet of the Apes franchise in general is the creativity and the various themes it goes through. The first one is just a straight up science fiction commentary on our world. But then for the second one, this is the horror episode of installment of Planet of the Apes. This is very in tune with, you know, some of the gothic horror of the early 1970s that was very popular. And then by the time we get to the third one, it's more of a drama and a thriller. You know, it's a much different film. And then the fourth one is a straight up exploitation action movie. And then the fifth one is a G-rated family movie. And so they never just tried to copy what they did before. They always went, now what do we give them? You know, so there were ideas. And that's the reason I love this film, is that, yeah, it's uneven. It's a little weird. But they weren't going for the same thing the last movie was. And that never changes. And how do you dislike that? The only thing that changes is the budget.
Yeah.
You know, they just keep halving it, you know, to where it's just really obvious. So, I love this. I think it's a packed house. I know it was a huge success. So, I love it.
That's great. That is excellent. I'm glad we all, you know, sometimes when there's this triangle, when there's a guest, it can get heated when it's two against one. And then we never know where to go from there. But
three angry men.
Yeah, exactly. But we did it, and we made it to the end of this episode. And Brian, I'm so happy that you were able to join us. I'm so glad Bill could make this happen.
Yeah, I've had a blast.
We'd like to offer you this time to give some plugs. Shout out your YouTube, your podcast, whatever you'd like to shout out for our audience.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I have a myriad of names because I want to make things complicated to find me. I'm BrickManTooth on YouTube. Everywhere else, I'm usually at Plaid Stallions, and Plaid Stallions is my website, and we publish a quarterly magazine about toys, and we have all kinds of other cool things going on. We have a podcast called Pod Stallions, and that's me.
That's great. That is great. Bill, would you like to say anything before taking us home?
I would. I'd once again like to echo Rob. Thank you so much for coming on, Brian. Dear listeners, I am a connoisseur of all the things that Brian does. If you are a child of the 60s and 70s and you haven't checked out any of his material, you really need to. It speaks to all the things that we love. It'll make you feel happy and nostalgic and warm watching him review things that we'd forgotten about and bring up memories that might have been long forgotten. And don't let that stop you if you're from the 80s and beyond. It's great stuff. I'm looking at my copy of Toy Ventures magazine right now with Dr. Zayas on the cover. So check out everything that he does.
It was one of my best-selling issues, actually.
It was awesome. Great. It was as close to getting a new Sears catalog that I could look at the toy section in the mail than I've ever seen.
That's what inspired the magazine, believe it or not.
So thank you very much for coming on. It was great. And, you know, we'd love to have you on again in the future for anything you'd like to talk about. Rob and I like to get into some weird movies when we can. When we did our Predator series, we started off with the Robo War, the Reb Brown Italian knockoff.
I love that movie.
Yeah, yes. We do too. So
that's a Bruno Mattei. Uh-huh. Yeah. Reb Brown saves that. He's bad. He's discount Arnold, but you're like, yeah, this is not bad.
Nope.
Yeah.
He's got a yell that is second to none.
Yeah, no, I don't really like a lot of Bruno Mattei's films, but that one is like, all right, you win. Yeah. This is your gold star. What was I going to just say? Oh, gosh.
Reb Brown.
If you do Caddyshack 2, I'm your man.
Bill, we got to throw it in after Apes. Let's do that.
Wow.
I do love the idea of a series of only sequels, too.
Fletch 2, there, because I was also the only guy in the theater.
Well, I was there with you because I still have my Fletch Lives poster that I bought at college that hung in the room, and everybody understood why I had that movie poster on the wall. But
and they still question it to this day.
I get questions about a lot of things.
I understand why we like each other.
I think so.
Well, Brian, Bill and I are going to stick around and do some closing credits and wrap-ups and make sure people hit up your stuff. But really, we will be reaching out again when we have some more stuff, especially Caddyshack 2. I am down.
Yeah, no, real blast, guys. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bill, Brian was great. Thank you so much for bringing him into the forefront. His YouTube page has been so much fun to watch. I love seeing all of these old toys. I cannot believe I didn't even know the magazine part of it.
Yeah, he does a lot of great work with the magazine. So I am a genuine fan of all the stuff he does. That is not just me plugging a guest. So go check it out if you want to have a good time. And I see so many things that I wanted so bad as a kid in that magazine.
Yeah. Well, let's say some nice things about other people as well. I want to thank Mrs. Columbo for listening to these episodes, making sure we're right on time. Rob Adler, editing these episodes, doing a great job. Love having you on the team. Draxium, Dr. Z for that kicking theme song. Jothan for our kicking show art. And you, listener, for being a Patreon member. Thank you for joining our Patreon. And hey, maybe we busted this episode outside of the paywall, Bill, because it was so good. And it's been a few weeks behind the paywall. Why don't you go check out the Bill and Rob's Patreon? Links in the show notes. And, you know, see what other episodes we've got back there. You probably realize we're covering all of the Planet of the Apes movies, listener. Well, you can go get them, as well as some other fun content that Bill and I are cooking up in our kitchen of media frenzy. I'm going off on a tangent, Bill. I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's what we base the show on, is just one big long tangent that just never ends. But hey, it's fun doing it.
Absolutely. Well, I look forward to doing it again and again. And I guess next time it will be with another Apes movie that I have never seen. What do we have next? Is it Conquest?
No. Next up is Escape from the Planet of the Apes.
That's right. Escape from the Planet. So we'll have Escape, and then we'll have Conquest, and then we will have Battle, right?
Uh-huh.
And then, hey, maybe we'll visit that Tim Burton one at some point. You never know.
Yeah, I'd say it's a good bet. But, you know, the best thing you can do is keep listening and find out, dear listeners.
You never know what's going to pop up in this Patreon. All right, Bill. Well, I'll see you next time.
All right. Rick, can't wait to go ape with you again, Robs. See ya.
Bye.